After the Civil War, folks in Georgia, still struggling with their loss, tried to rebuild and return to life as it had been before the war. For a time, cotton production re-emerged in Georgia's economy. But with slavery abolished, many plantations couldn't afford to continue. As the Southern Rail Network expanded, industrialization was encouraged in Georgia. And Henry Grady, owner of the Atlanta Constitution, led the effort to build cotton mills in every town. Bring the cotton mills to the cotton fields. The explosion of cotton mills in Georgia was profitable, and soon northern businessmen were investing in southern mills. The northern investors preferred the South for business because of lower taxes, no union, plenty of willing workers, and much cheaper labor than in the North. The mills created jobs, and many rural farmers gave up their mules and went to work in the factories. Factory owners took advantage of cheap labor provided by women, minorities, and even children. Times were hard in the South, and the whole family had to work. And there was no minimum wage and no child labor laws. And in 1910 in Georgia, 25% of the workforce were children, often working 50 to 60 hours a week for 5 to 10 cents a day. And the child wages were high enough that parents often depended on their children's earnings. But as long as they had an abundance of children willing to work, there was no incentive to raise adult wages. It was just another cycle of poverty. The poor depended on the rich for wages, but they were often bitter over how they and their children were being taken advantage of.
The sources for today's episode are going to be listed on our show notes. And I just want you to be advised that this case is from the early 1900s. There are some racial insensitivities that will be in this episode. This episode is also dealing with the murder of a child. I'm Darlene.
I'm Melody.
This is Hard Times and True Crimes. So we're going to be talking about a little girl named Mary Fagan. Mary was born in Florence, Alabama, on June 1st in 1899, to her mother, Frances Benton. Everybody called her Fanny. We've had three Fannies now.
Being that we do historical cases, I guess that name was popular.
Mm-hmm. So sadly, Mary would never meet her father, William, because he contracted measles and passed away 4 months before she was born. Isn't that sad?
It is sad.
He was just 25 years old, and the couple already had three children, and Mary would be their fourth. Fanny, now a widow with four children at 24 years old, moved with her children back to her hometown where her parents lived in the backwoods of Marietta, Georgia. Her family were tenant farmers. We've talked about tenant farmers quite a bit on some past episodes. And Fanny would have been familiar with that kind of labor and able to work to support her children. So in 1910, the family would move to East Point, Georgia, where Fanny opened up a little boarding house, and her four children would have to go to work in various factories. These were tough times for Southerners, and Mary Fagan's family was no exception. The family had always been tenant farmers. We've talked about that cycle of poverty, and it was around this time farmers and sharecroppers would see an opportunity to leave the farm and to move into cities like Atlanta, where textile mills and other mills were popping up. These families were usually so poor that when they arrived, the whole family had to pitch in and go to work, no matter how young or old they were.
That was very common.
Yes, it was. And it sounds harsh, but if you think about it, children on the farm had to work just as hard. There was no welfare back then.
That was survival.
It was. And if you didn't work, you didn't eat and you didn't have a place to live.
Right.
So many of factory workers at that time were just little children because there were no child labor laws. And so at just 10 years old, Mary Fagan had to quit school and go to work at a textile mill to help put food on her family's table. Mary's mom, Fanny, met and married a man named John Coleman. He was really good to Fanny and to her children. He would be the only father that Mary ever knew. It was a good marriage, but the family was still poor. In 1912, that next spring, Mary got a job working for the National Pencil Company. The superintendent of the factory was named Leo Frank. He was a 29-year-old American-born Jewish man from New York City. Mary's job was to run a machine that put erasers into the, you know, those metal tips on top of pencils?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So she typically worked 55 hours a week.
Goodness.
And she earned 10 cents an hour.
Oh, my.
About $5 a week.
So she's working. I mean, you think about that. We complain about getting 40
yep.
or more.
More than a grown man today.
Wow.
In today's time, that would translate to her making less than $150 a week.
Man.
So they were being exploited.
Definitely.
Mary Fagan was described by friends and family as beautiful. She was friendly. She was happy. She had light auburn hair and a sweet smile. One of her neighbors said if she put on a toe sack, she'd come out looking like a morning glory. That's Southern for she was real pretty.
Yeah.
Her mother, Fanny, would recall how easy Mary was to please. She said on her birthdays, you know, they didn't have extra money for gifts and parties, but she would just cook her a little something special at dinner. And she talked about what that meant to Mary and how special it was to her. She said she was really easy to please. The least little thing made her happy. Mary laughed a lot and loved to make her friends and family laugh too. She'd come home in the evenings from work and tell funny stories about people she worked with and things that had happened at the mill that day. Fanny, Mary's mom, felt guilty that she had to go to work so young. She'd always walk her out in the mornings and wait with Mary for her ride to come to take her to the pencil factory. She wore a locket with her mother's picture inside.
Oh, that's sweet.
That actually made me tear up.
Yeah.
Mary had only worked a couple of shifts that week, though, the week of April 21st through the 26th of 1913, because a shipment of the metal Mary worked with was late. And since she had to have that metal to do her job, she was sent home and then they just call her back, mm-hmm. you know, when the shipment came in. Helen Ferguson, Mary's good friend and coworker, who was her age and a neighbor, asked their boss, Leo Frank, on Friday afternoon if she couldn't just pick up Mary's pay for her so she didn't have to come all the way down to the factory. Mm-hmm. She'd done that for Mary a time or two before, and Mary really appreciated it. But this time, Mr. Frank told Helen no, that Mary could just come and get it herself the next day. And that ended up being fine because Mary had planned to go to the big parade downtown in Atlanta on Saturday anyway. Saturday, April 26th, 1913, was Confederate Memorial Day. It was a big deal in the South, an annual holiday to honor the men who had died or were wounded during the Civil War. Did you know that that was Yeah, me either.
No, never heard of it.
The Union's northern states also had their Memorial Day in remembrance of their fallen soldiers. It had been less than 50 years since the Civil War ended. And if you think about it, countless fathers, sons, brothers had lost their life.
Right.
And in 1913, those wounds were still pretty fresh.
Absolutely.
Especially for Southerners who weren't really recovered yet from the losses of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Or during the Battle of Atlanta, 40% of the city was burned to the ground by Union General Sherman's troops.
Yes.
And an estimated 9,255 Confederate and Union soldiers were killed in that battle alone. So Atlantans were still picking up the pieces even 50 years later.
Absolutely. I remember that was Sherman's March to the Sea.
Yes.
That's what they called that.
Mm-hmm. So that Saturday, in commemoration of the holiday, there was going to be a big parade. They'd sing old battle hymns. There'd be speeches given by Confederate veterans. And dinners all over the city in their honor. Most businesses in Atlanta closed down for the celebrations, including the pencil factory where Mary worked, but Superintendent Leo Frank would be there doing paperwork so she could come in and get her pay, and several others probably would too. Mary ate her breakfast that morning, and it was a usual breakfast of cabbage and bread.
Oh,
I know. That's different, right?
That's not what I would want for breakfast. Did you say it was a usual? Like,
yeah,
that's what
that was common.
Mm-hmm. I guess if you were poor.
Right.
Yeah.
She told her family bye, and she headed out at 11 a.m., all dressed up for the parade in her violet dress, carrying a parasol and a silver mesh purse.
Oh, I can picture that.
I know. Mary rode the trolley to downtown Atlanta, which she always did for work. Then she walked to the four-story pencil factory on South Forsyth Street at about 12 o'clock noon. Mary went into the main entrance and up the stairs to the second floor, and that's where she worked, and it's also where Superintendent Leo Frank's office is located. So she walked in, and she gave Frank her employee ID number, and he gave her the $1.20 that she was owed for those 12 hours of work. That would be the last time that Mary Fagan was seen alive. At 3 a.m., Newt Lee, a black man who was the pencil factory's night watchman, went to the basement to use what was referred to back then as the colored toilet. To his horror, he stumbled on the dead body of a young girl. Lee was terrified, as you can imagine.
Sure.
And he ran to call the police as fast as he could. He also tried to get a hold of his superintendent, but he couldn't get an answer on his phone. Lee met authorities at the front of the factory and took them to the basement. The electricity was turned off, and so they had to actually climb down a ladder to get to the basement. And it was turned off because when the superintendent would leave in the evenings, he would turn off the electricity. The night watchman would just carry around a lantern. And when he would come back the next morning, he would turn back on the electricity.
Oh, okay.
So that was common. Now, I'm going to give a disclaimer here because I'm going to describe what they found when they came down there. Okay.
So it's graphic.
It is graphic. And if you're sensitive, you might want to skip ahead maybe about 30 seconds. The girl was laying face down with bruises and cuts all over her poor body. She was bloody and filthy from the soot that covered the basement floor. So dirty that at first police couldn't tell if she was black or white. She had a black eye and wounds on her scalp. Her dress, it was torn and pulled up around her waist. Her underwear were also bloody, which most likely meant that she'd been sexually assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
A piece of her underclothes was tied around her neck.
Oh.
Her dress was soaked with urine and blood.
Oh.
There was also a cord wrapped so tightly around her neck that it literally cut into her skin.
Mm.
They believe that that cord was used to lower her body into the basement from a hole in the floor above. The investigators found a metal pipe and found blood on the victim's jacket. They figured that the metal pipe was probably used to beat the girl's head because she did have extensive head wounds, but coroners ruled her cause of death as strangulation.
It just sounds so violent, too. I mean, all of that that you're describing,
mm-hmm.
That's just horrible.
So there beside her body on the nasty floor were two barely legible notes. This was pretty interesting, and I'm going to read these notes to you. They're hard to understand, first of all, and this is using some of the language that uncomfortable to say.
Okay.
But this is what the note said. One of them read, "He said he would love me. The night witch did it. That long, tall, black Negro did by himself." And the second one read, "Ma'am, that Negro higher down here did this. I went to make water and he pushed me down that hole. That long, tall Negro, black, that who it was, long, slim, tall Negro, I write while play with me."
Hmm.
Yeah.
So obviously it's supposedly written from her.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very suspicious sounding letter.
Yes. Yes. It definitely is. Newt Lee, the night watch, he was a tall black man. And they assumed that by night witch, the writer meant night watch.
Yeah, that's what I assumed when I heard it.
He did seem nervous, which to me is completely understandable.
If he had just stumbled upon that body.
He was a black man in the South at the turn of the century who had just found the dead body of a white girl.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew she was white. And that also seemed suspicious to them because they couldn't tell if she was black or white, but he said the reason that he could was by her hair.
Okay.
Like, and that makes sense.
Yes.
There's a difference in black and white hair.
And so he knew,
mm-hmm.
and had he told authorities that, I guess, when he reported that he had found her?
Yes.
Okay. You probably read that, not just
for No, me. I didn't.
Okay.
I didn't, yeah. For some reason, this anxiousness by him was suspicious to police. He explained, you know, he was innocent because they were questioning him, of course, digging into him and what he knew. You know, he told them, I was just doing my job. But they arrested Newt Lee right away on charges of suspicion. He was arrested before they even knew who she was.
Okay. And, I mean, he's the one that found the body.
He found her body. The notes had incriminated him. He didn't have an alibi, and they thought he acted nervous. I will say they didn't just settle on him.
Mm-hmm. So where did they find those notes?
Like, right beside her.
Wouldn't he have seen those and gotten rid of them?
Right. The whole thing, I mean, is somebody just going to, is he going to let her sit right there and write a note about him while he's killing her?
Right.
She died a violent death. Mm-hmm. Could she write?
Right. It just seems a little hard to believe.
But now they needed to know who the victim was. One of the detectives, by the last name Rogers, had a niece named Grace Hicks who worked at the pencil factory. He drove to her house and asked if she would try to identify the corpse. She agreed and was driven to the factory at about 6 a.m. Grace fainted the minute she saw the body.
Must have been really bad.
When she was revived, she told detectives that the body belonged to her friend.
Oh, no.
13-year-old Mary Fagan. She and Mary worked together at the same machine. Grace was heartbroken and traumatized. She told the detectives she was the best girl I knew. When she was identified, they realized that her purse and her pay that she'd gone there to collect, they were both missing.
Okay. So there, I mean, like, it raises the possibility that they were somebody, a robbery.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, authorities finally managed to get a hold of Leo Frank on the phone. They didn't tell him what had happened, but just that there had been an incident at the factory and that they were sending a car for him. So Rogers, the same one that went to pick up Grace Hicks, he drove to Superintendent Leo Frank's home in the Jewish district of Atlanta. Frank was mostly already dressed, but he did seem extremely anxious, even shaken a little bit. He was fast talking and his voice was hoarse. He wanted to know if there'd been a fire. He kept saying he needed coffee and he wasn't in a hurry to go with the detective. In fact, he was hesitant to leave before he could eat his breakfast. The first stop was to the undertaker. Frank was asked if he knew Mary Fagan. He said that the name did not sound familiar to him. I guess you can read it either way. He did work on the same floor that she did. You know, pretty close, actually, to where her machine was his office. But he was the superintendent. You know, he had a lot of employees. He asked if she worked at the factory. Rogers explained that yes, she did, and that she had been found murdered in the basement. Frank was then escorted to view Mary's body, and he was visibly skittish and really uncomfortable. He didn't even really look at her. In fact, he had to be redirected, like, hey, you need to take a closer look. And at that point, he did remember the girl coming in to pick up her pay around noon on Saturday.
That was my other question a minute ago. I was thinking, well, she had just come in to get her check, and he had told her, no, just wait. Like, somebody was going to pick it up for her, and then he said, no, she can get it when she comes back. So it seems like her name would have been fresh on his brain.
Right.
To me.
Well, he said that when she came in that she gave her employee ID number.
Okay.
He said that he paid her.
Well, that does make sense.
Based on that. And he said that he had stayed in his office working for about 25 minutes after she left. He still claimed not to know her name, but he said that he could verify it by looking at the books for Saturday.
Okay.
So detectives took Frank back to the factory, and he verified the girl who came in Saturday for her pay was Mary Fagan. Detectives then asked him to look over Newt Lee's time card to see if anything looked suspicious. At various times during the night, he had to punch in. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in front of the detectives, he looked at Newt Lee's time card and said, yeah, everything
looked right.
Yeah, everything looked good. So the electricity had been off when detectives had arrived earlier that morning, and they'd had to climb down that ladder. Remember I told you that?
To the basement.
Mm-hmm. But now that Frank was there, he turned on the electricity and they rode the elevator down, where as soon as the elevator hit the bottom floor, it smashed down on a big, fresh pile of human poop.
Ooh.
Yeah. And of course, everyone down there notice that disgusting stench. And I'm not just telling you that because it's gross. It's actually important information that I'll come back to. Okay. Keep that in mind. But back to Leo Frank. Authorities were a little thrown off by his response to the murder. He was nervous, but kind of cold and indifferent to the actual murder. Mm-hmm. It was like he cared only to the point that it affected him in the factory.
Okay.
Leo was born in Cura, Texas in 1884 to Rudolph and Ray Frank. Shortly after his birth, they moved to Brooklyn, New York, where he went to high school at Pratt Institution and then went to the prestigious Cornell University. He majored in mechanical engineering. Pretty dang smart. Frank was also involved in sports during his college days, as well as being on the debate team. He seemed to have a well-rounded education. He graduated in 1906, and then in 1907, his rich uncle, Moses Frank, presented him with an opportunity to move to the South, Atlanta, Georgia, to become the superintendent of the National Pencil Company. He then sent Frank for a 9-month apprenticeship to a pencil factory in Germany, where he learned certain skills that he would need to know to run a pencil factory.
Okay. And I'm wondering, what kind of skills do you need to run a pencil factory? I don't know.
No idea. Yeah. Who knows? In 1908, Leo began his job as supervisor of the factory. Leo was 5'6". He was kind of short. He was thin, kind of frail looking. He wore Coke bottle glasses. He sounds like a big nerd, but if you look at pictures of him, he was kind of cute.
I was going to say, we like nerds here, so no.
I thought he was kind of good looking.
No offense.
It wasn't long after his move to Atlanta that he found somebody else who thought he was cute.
Wait, and I want to say, we like nerds who aren't murderers. Exactly. So I'm waiting to hear what happens.
Lucille, okay, I don't know how to pronounce her name, but it's S-E-L-I-G.
Selig?
That's her last name.
Selig.
Selig, something like that. And she was from a prominent Jewish family. And in 1910, Leo and Lucille married on East Georgia Avenue in her parents' home. And they continued to live there with her parents after their marriage. Frank, he grew in popularity in the Jewish community there in Atlanta and actually elected president of Atlanta's chapter of B'nai B'rith. I think I'm saying that right.
I have no idea.
It's a Jewish organization.
Okay.
Leo and Lucille seemed in love from everything I've heard and I've read about the two. They treated each other really well. They did things together like, you know, they went to the opera and they played bridge and, you know, those kind of things rich people do. I do think that they had fertility issues and that can be hard on a couple. Mm-hmm. And you never know what other issues there may or may not have been behind closed doors. Either way, Leo Frank had been running the pencil company for 5 years up until 1913 when Mary Fagan was murdered.
Okay.
As you can imagine, newspapers very quickly started pumping out stories about Mary's murder.
Absolutely. I'm sure it was headline.
Oh, yeah. On May 4th, 1913, an article in the Atlanta Constitution said, "The murder of Mary Fagan has gripped and stirred the people of Atlanta as nothing that has ever happened before. It's as if she were the daughter of each person. She was just an innocent, pure little girl." The newspaper published a picture of Mary that would melt a heart of stone. Atlanta was stunned. They were angry and they wanted justice. And they were already kind of up in arms about the child labor stuff going on.
Mm-hmm. The Industrial Revolution probably mm-hmm. was going on or had happened recently.
And those
children working those long hours was probably a big issue at the forefront. And don't we all, when we hear about the death of a child, we all feel like, you know, that could have been mine.
Yes.
And we want justice for that.
Absolutely. And two, this is a southern state, obviously, Atlanta, Georgia. And this Jewish New Yorker moves down here, they feel like they're exploiting their kids.
Oh,
so it wasn't just him, but there was just kind of a mistrust in general of these factories coming in and mm-hmm. employing all these children. Georgia in particular, most states had laws, you know, you couldn't employ kids unless they were 12, mm-hmm. but in Georgia, they were working as young as like 10, which is Mary Fagan did.
So she started that young.
Right. Yeah. And so people just weren't super happy about it.
I would imagine too, and maybe this is what you're talking about, being in the South,
mm-hmm.
Because the Northern corporations moving down into the yes. territory after that Civil War and the Reconstruction, there was a lot of mistrust.
Yes.
In that.
There was.
Yeah.
And they felt like they were coming down now and
taking over, our territory and our livelihoods and our homes. And you've done away with our way of life.
Right.
To support ourselves. And now you're moving in with your corporations.
That's exactly right. Yes. So that was the sentiment, kind of the backdrop.
Okay.
Now, three other men were also arrested on suspicion. Arthur Mullinex, who had been a streetcar driver and had known Mary because he used to take her back and forth to work. And he was a little friendly, maybe flirtatious, mm-hmm. you know, it depend on how you read it. But he was arrested because a witness had came forward saying that they had seen him with Mary earlier in the day and that she looked as if she'd been drugged.
Oh, that's kind of creepy and suspicious.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And then another guy, John Gant, who had previously been a bookkeeper at the pencil factory, was also arrested. He had recently been fired for stealing, or I don't know if he was stealing or just the books were coming up a little short.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, he was fired. He was let go. But he had shown up at the factory that day, the day of the murder,
mm-hmm.
and said that he needed to look for shoes that he'd left there. And it was common knowledge that he had a thing for Mary.
Okay. Well, and that looks bad, too, then.
Right.
And he was there that day.
He was there that day. And another black man was arrested as well, but his identity isn't known. I'm not sure
who that was. So maybe they cleared him pretty quickly?
They did. Okay. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they still have Newt Lee
mm-hmm.
in custody. And then the papers put forth a $2,000 reward, which was a lot of money, for information leading to the arrest of Mary Fagan's murderer.
Okay, but let me just clarify. But that Leo Frank has not been.
Mm-mm.
Okay, because I just.
Yeah. So you have to know by now that race is going to play a part in this story.
Right.
Because of the arrested suspects so far, right?
Of course, yes.
But I have to say that it does seem to me that authorities genuinely wanted to get it right.
Okay.
They could have settled.
Mm-hmm.
They could have settled on the night watchman.
Easily. But they did research and find these other suspects. And
I don't know that they had enough to arrest him, but I don't think they had enough to arrest the two white guys either.
Right. They're following their leads.
They continued their investigation and didn't get tunnel vision with Newt Lee. But they soon figured the real child killer probably wrote those notes to point attention to Lee and away from themselves.
And it does seem like that when mm-hmm. you just the reading of the note, it sounded awfully suspicious like that.
Well, you know, we talked about how violently she was murdered, and these notes were written precisely on the lines of the paper.
Yeah, I'm not buying it.
Mm-mm. I mean, it was sloppily written, but it was written on those lines, adding to the improbability.
Exactly.
When Mary's parents came in and looked at the handwriting, they knew right away that that was not Mary's.
Okay.
Although she hadn't had much of an education, her writing and grammar was far more advanced than what was written in those notes. And mm-hmm. the handwriting just didn't match.
Yeah. And see, to me, that already clears Newt Lee, because if that wasn't her that wrote that and he was the one who killed her, he wouldn't be incriminating himself with those letters.
Right. Well, they still held him, even though they were starting to have their doubts.
Okay.
Now, Leo's Frank's bosses, the higher-ups in the factories, they went ahead and hired an attorney for him. I think they realized kind of what was coming.
Mm-hmm.
His attorney pointed out that Leo Frank, he didn't have any scratches or marks on his body, and that would be unlikely with such a vicious murder. There was no blood or smut on his clothing. The factory also hired the Pinkertons.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, a well-known private yes. detective agency to join in the investigation.
Okay.
Although the public, they still thought that Newt Lee was the police's strongest suspect. But investigators were secretly growing more suspicious of Leo Frank.
Okay.
This is crazy. So, you know, they found the notes, mm-hmm. right, incriminating him. Well, they also went to his house, to Newtley's
house, mm-hmm, okay.
Because, you know, they're doing their due diligence, they're investigating, and they found a blood-stained shirt at his home and a burn barrel.
Hmm.
And normally something like this would really incriminate somebody, but despite the blood around mostly the armpits, it was very thick in those areas, almost as if it had been put there. And the shirt looked like it was brand new, like it had never been worn.
So as if somebody had planted it?
Mm-hmm.
And what do you mean by it was thick? Like somebody had...
Somebody had like dipped it.
Oh, okay.
In a lot of cases, that would have been it for him.
Right. That would have been like your smoking gun. Like, okay, we've got our evidence. This is it's it. Him.
But instead, detectives believed that the shirt had been planted to set Lee up. First, the notes most likely being planted, and now the shirt. Leo Frank also came back and said that he'd made a mistake and that Lee had missed several different check-ins on the night of the murder. And this stood out as suspicious as well, because on the day of the murder, Frank told investigators that he looked at it while he looked at those cards.
He did.
While they were there. And he told them at that point that everything looked good with Newtley's time card.
Mm-hmm.
So even the Pinkerton detectives, which was hired kind of to, you know,
make him look good,
they were starting to grow suspicious of him.
Hmm.
Frank was questioned multiple times and, of course, denied any wrongdoing. Police even put Newtley and Leo Frank in the same room because they felt like one of them could possibly...
So they were kind of setting them up to see if one of them would mess up and give themselves away, maybe?
Yes. Frank told Newtley to please tell the truth. And Newtley continually said that before God, he was being truthful. He did not waver. But Leo Frank, you know, he didn't either.
Hmm.
Meanwhile, young girls who were factory employees came forward claiming that Frank had been verbally and physically inappropriate with them.
It's not looking good for Leo Frank.
Making them feel uncomfortable. A 13-year-old boy came forward named George Epps, who was a good friend of Mary's, and he testified that he had been with Mary on the morning of the murder. They had ridden the trolley together and walked together until they split up at Forsyth Street. They had planned to meet back up at Peachtree and Five Point Street, where they were going to go get ice cream and watch the parade together. George claimed Mary was uncomfortable with her boss, Leo Frank, because he had been inappropriately flirtatious with her in the past. He said that she'd ask him to go to the factory with her to pick up her money, but he had an errand that he needed to run as well. And George deeply regretted not going with her that day.
You can imagine that he probably carried a burden of feeling guilty.
Oh, I'm sure.
I always try not to, you know, make assumptions until the end of the story, but I'm like already assuming I know that Frank did that.
Another girl, Montine Stover, who came into Frank's office to pick up her check directly after Mary, said that Frank was not in his office when she got there, and she ended up having to leave the factory without getting paid. But Frank had told investigators that he'd been in his office doing paperwork for about 25 minutes after Mary had left his office. Do you remember that?
Yeah, story's not lining up.
She also said that the metal room door was closed, and this is now where detectives suspected Mary was murdered.
Oh, and how close
and it was closed.
Where was that? On the same floor? Yes. And it was like maybe near the offices?
Right. Also, Newtley said that Frank acted suspicious that day. He had asked Newtley to come into the factory at about 4 p.m. that day to start a shift. Frank was going to leave early. He was going to go to a baseball game with his brother-in-law. So he told him to come in. But when he showed up to start a shift, Frank told Lee that he was sorry, but he wasn't going to go to the game after all. And he said he needed to stay at the factory and finish his work. He told Newt to go and have some fun at the parade and then to come back to work at about 6. Lee was tired. He worked night shift. So he asked if he couldn't just stay at the factory and sleep instead. But Frank said no, that he needed to go and go have some fun.
Yeah. See, he's trying. It's just so obvious, though, that he's trying to get rid of him.
Lee also said that after Frank left the factory, he called and asked if everything was all right. This is about 7 o'clock. That stood out because Frank had never done that before. Now, in fairness, though, Lee had only been working there for about 3 weeks. Arthur Mullinax and John Gant, the two who were suspects, and the unknown black man, three of the five suspects, they were released after investigators secured alibis. But Leo Frank was arrested for suspicion of murder, and Newt Lee was still being held.
Okay.
But then another man was brought into the investigation. A 29-year-old black man by the name of Jim Conley, who was the factory's janitor. So the day watchman had caught Conley washing what looked like blood out of a blue shirt.
Man, mm-hmm. This just gets deeper and deeper.
The watchman called police and Conley was also arrested. He had a pretty lengthy record already. The most serious charges were attempted armed robbery, but he had other things like disorderly conduct. He drank a lot, those kinds of things.
That's going to increase your chances of being charged or even convicted of it because, I mean, I know there are people who are like on death row and stuff mm-hmm. that are innocent based on, you know, they have a prior record of violent assaults or what have you.
Right.
And then sometimes they turn out to be not the guilty party in that crime. So, you know, don't commit crimes and get a bad rap sheet. And you Seriously. Have less of a chance of being falsely accused of a crime you didn't commit.
Yes. And the thing is that back then, with so little physical evidence,
right,
character was a huge...
Right. They didn't have DNA to go on.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, yes. they relied heavily on character, yes. character witnesses.
And your past rap exactly. sheet or whatever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He claimed that he was completely innocent and had no knowledge whatsoever of the crime. Conley also claimed that he couldn't have written the notes because he is illiterate.
Well, okay.
Yeah. Couldn't read or write. But Leo Frank was like, that's a lie. He can write because he's done my inventory for me before.
Okay.
So on Friday, April 25th, Conley admitted that he lied about being illiterate and not being able to write. And police did a handwriting analysis to compare his handwriting to that of the murder notes. And there was no doubt that Conley had written those notes.
Oh, twist.
Now he was ready to talk.
I'm sure he was. Okay. You always have these stories with like these twists.
He admitted to detectives that the blood on the shirt that he was washing out was in fact Mary Fagan's blood.
What?
And that he had written those notes. He said that he had not been the one to murder her. In his fifth version of the story, Conley said that his boss, Leo Frank, had asked him to write the notes and told him what to write. He said that he was Leo Frank's guard for when he would seduce young girls in the factory.
Oh, my goodness.
Frank told him in the case of Mary Fagan that he'd wanted to be with her, but Mary had resisted. He had used violent force by punching her in the face and some other things, but he hadn't meant to kill her. He claimed Frank was going to pay him to help carry Mary's dead body down to the basement via the elevator. What happened was he was going to pay Conley to do it himself, but Conley said that her body was too heavy and he couldn't do it, so he needed Frank's help, and so they both took her down to the basement via the elevator.
Okay.
For some reason, police believed him, and that honestly shocks me. They had a lot of evidence there, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a crazy story. So he's saying, I didn't murder her. I'm an accessory to murder.
Right.
How credible is he? He's obviously been lying, his fifth version of the story. And I have to say, I'm still intrigued about the poop under the elevator.
Yeah, you should be, because that's definitely coming up. But this case has been very divisive. A lot of people believe that Jewish people and Yankees were highly discriminated against in the South back then, even, you know, to the point to where they would have been more sympathetic to Conley or to Newt Lee because they were at least one of their own. However, I'm not saying there was no anti-Semitism, because...
Wait a minute. They would have been more sympathetic to Newt Lee because he was in the... Even though he was a black man, he was still in the South. He was a Southern man?
Yes. That's what Leo Frank supporters say.
Okay.
No, I'm not saying there was no anti-Semitism, but I am saying I personally believe that it paled in comparison to the blatant racism against black people at that time.
Okay, because it was the early 1900s. I mean, again, it wasn't that far from the Civil War.
Yeah, and Atlanta Jews had a thriving community. Black people did not. A lot of people believe Leo Frank was targeted simply because he was Jewish, and that racism was the biggest factor in this case. They don't believe he would have ever been even charged with murder had he not been Jewish.
Okay, so we have a black suspect, a Jewish suspect, and mm-hmm. then Connolly is...
He's also black.
Okay. Yeah. I might have missed that. And he's got a prior history of crime.
Right.
Okay.
Yep. So I believe newspapers like the Atlanta Georgian printed persuasive kind of anti-Frank articles, but also the Atlanta Constitution printed articles like keep an open mind. You know, we've had several suspects here. We don't know mm-hmm. who it is. So I think that, but I do think the people of Atlanta were so hungry for justice that they needed an object for their scorn. They were really hard on Leo Frank, but when they believed that Newt Lee was guilty, they were just as hard on him. And in fact, they were talking about killing him.
About killing
Newt Lee.
Oh.
Yeah. This is, you know, early on when they believed that he had done it. Yeah. So what I'm saying is I think that they wanted to know who did it, and they wanted justice. On July 28th, 1913, Leo Frank's trial began in the Fulton County Superior Court. Judge Leonard Roan was the judge. Leo Frank's defense was made up of 8 attorneys, which is pretty impressive for that, you know, for 1913. It's interesting to note that the jury were all white males. 2 black jurors were dismissed because Leo Frank's defense wanted them dismissed. And there were about 250 court spectators. Frank's attorneys didn't try to have the trial move anywhere because they figured that Frank's reputation, it would speak for itself in the city where, you know, he had friends and family and he had worked and he had built a life. He had a lot of supporters there. The Atlanta Georgian, the newspaper, hired William Manning Smith to be Jim Conley's attorney that was caught washing out his shirt. This newspaper, the guy, the owner of this newspaper, hired
him an attorney.
Okay.
That's why. That's kind of puzzling.
That's very surprising. Very surprising for one thing that it was allowed and for the other that they were willing to do it.
Yeah.
This attorney had a reputation for representing and helping several black people beat their court cases. And in that time, that was not easy to do.
And they were trying to help Conley?
Mm-hmm. People believed him.
Okay.
They probably had their own motives. I kind of think it evened the score as far as representation goes, because they both had really good attorneys. Conley's lawyer did believe his client, but he was really worried about the interviews he was given, the press from jail, because he was worried that even though the owner of the Georgian supported him, he did not think that a lot of these reporters did.
Okay.
So he was concerned for his client.
Yeah. Are they both on trial for this murder?
Yes. Did they hire this attorney to smear him? Do you know what I mean? Like, who knows what their motives were?
Right. It's just odd all the way around.
It is odd.
Yeah.
Of course, the trial was gut-wrenching for Mary's family.
I'm sure. And it was probably a media circus, too.
Oh, it was. And her mother, Fanny, was the first of the prosecutor's witnesses. Mm. She was wearing her mourning clothes still. She was all in black.
Oh.
And hearing details about the murder and she had to identify Mary's bloody, tattered dress.
I would hate that.
And that just caused her to completely lose her composure.
That would be a horrible, horrible thing for a mom to have to do.
Yes. And almost everyone in the court would be moved to tears, or at least visibly showed signs of emotion for Mary Fagan's mom and sympathy for the family.
Absolutely.
But Leo Frank really didn't. Yeah, he was just kind of stone-faced and unfazed. I don't know.
Well, I'm sure his lawyers, though. I mean, don't the lawyers advise you, you know, to not show emotion?
Right. Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought of that. He didn't offer the family any support, didn't go to their house and, you know, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, as the superintendent of the company. Yeah, because you would expect that.
You would think.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just a common courtesy.
It is.
So he was actually very cold and indifferent. And that doesn't, it's not a good look.
No.
Especially when the whole city is, they're not indifferent. That doesn't make him guilty. But anyway, George Epps, Mary's friend, he took the stand next and he told about how the two of them were supposed to meet back to have ice cream and watch the parade at about 1 p.m. after Mary collected her pay, and how he'd went to a ball game after because, you know, she didn't show up. Newt Lee testified about finding Mary's body. He told the court how he'd called authorities, how he'd spoke. Then he talked about what he perceived to be strange behavior coming from Leo Frank.
Okay.
He was then cross-examined for almost 5 hours by the defense. That's a long
That's a very long time.
And he stood up under it.
Good for him.
Like, yeah, he didn't waver. A factory worker testified about finding some blood stains and hair beside a machine on the second floor where Mary Leo worked and Leo Frank's office was, and also testified about finding Mary Fagan's empty pay envelope. Montine Stover testified about coming to Frank's office at 12:05 to pick up her pay and waiting for 5 minutes in there before leaving the factory empty-handed. Frank stated that he had been in his office, I said, for 25 minutes. And, you know, that was the time that Mary Fagan was murdered.
Okay, so they did pinpoint the time of the murder.
They did, because Dr. Roy Harris took the stand and said that Mary had been murdered between 12 and 1. And he based that on the breakdown of her stomach contents, which was the bread and cabbage that she'd eaten that morning. So then Jim Conley took the stand on days 7 and 8 of the trial, and those were the most crucial. Judge Roan asked all women and children to leave the court because his testimony was so explicit and so gory.
Yeah.
Jim Conley was a star witness for the prosecution, and really both the prosecution and the defense kind of rested on Jim Conley's testimony.
Yes.
He retold the story as of how he had been Frank's lookout as he sexually assaulted the girl, as he had done for Frank many times in the past. So he was saying, you know, I was hired for that, did it on many occasions. He told how Frank had said he'd accidentally killed Mary after he'd become violent because of her refusing him, and how he, Conley, had helped Frank move the body into the basement by way of the elevator. Frank had wanted him to move the body himself. I think I told you that, but he couldn't lift her. She was too heavy. And so Frank ended up helping him. He said Frank promised him $200 as long as he kept his mouth shut, and as long as Frank didn't get arrested. Frank also made the statement, and this is a quote, "Why should I hang?" He said that Frank had dictated the notes to him in an attempt to frame Newt Lee.
So he was going to throw him under the bus from the beginning.
Under cross-examination, Conley admitted that he had changed his story several times, that he'd been the one to poop down in the elevator shaft because he was asked about that. So he had done that.
Why? Like, but he just had to go or what?
He said that he had to go. He went that morning, which we'll talk about. I'll talk about that a little bit more.
That's it's bizarre. Still,
yeah, it really is. But that it's actually an important piece of evidence. Conley also managed to stick to his story, even under hours and hours of cross-examination. And he held up. The prosecution argued, now this is terrible language, they argued that a Negro couldn't have made up a story in such detail and been able to stick to the story under such duress as the defense cross-examination.
Wow.
Yeah. Basically saying a black person wasn't capable or smart enough.
Yeah, you had alluded to that earlier. That, like, wow, interesting.
Somewhere around 19 girls testified that Frank had been inappropriate with them, both verbally and physically. 16-year-old Nellie Wood testified how Frank had pushed himself against her and touched her breast. 14-year-old Nellie Pettis, a witness for the prosecution, said Frank had propositioned her for sex, and so on.
So Frank's a pervert.
And even that doesn't make him a murderer, though.
No, but he just sounds guilty. I mean, like, that's right. A lot of girls coming forward.
It is. And it's interesting that while the defense did not miss an opportunity to rebut prosecution, they chose not to cross-examine these girls.
Doesn't mean that he was the actual one that killed her, but...
I know what you're saying.
I'm not taking it for him. I think he did it, and I think he's... I think even though it doesn't make him a murderer, I think it points to his character and...
Right. I hear what you're saying. Yeah. But then other girls came forward saying they had no such experience like that with Frank, nor did they have any knowledge of him being that way with any of the other girls. There was a lot of accusations back and forth about tampering with witnesses.
Okay. But 19?
So, I know. That is a lot. And they did not cross-examine.
Right.
That... Frank's attorneys make some strange statements about this in a closing argument that I'll go over in a few minutes.
Okay.
Frank took the stand in his own defense. He spoke for several hours, and he told about his life and his duties at the factory. He talked about how happy his marriage was. He went over details about his paperwork that he was doing in his office that Saturday. Now, I do believe he was you know how some people are just socially awkward? Either he's a pervert or he was socially awkward. I don't know which.
Okay.
Do you know what I'm saying? Yes. And sometimes those people are misjudged as being weird.
Yes.
And they're not.
Right.
They're just awkward.
I'm following that. Yeah.
He talked about the paperwork and the details that he was doing in the paperwork that day. So he was basically going over accounts that Saturday. And he showed the jury, making the case that how in the world could he have killed Mary Fagan, and then sat at his desk and finished this tedious work. And it was verified by several people that, you know, different people had come to his office that Saturday. 5 minutes after Mary left, a foreman testified that he'd come into Frank's office and talked to him for a minute. He absolutely did leave his office at 12:45. They believe that Mary was murdered just after 12. He left the office at 12:45 to go home to eat lunch.
So he has an alibi, if you believe one set of testimonies.
Yes.
And not if you believe the other set of testimonies.
That's exactly right.
And both sides of this have been testified to in court.
Yep. Wow. And they both accused the other of, you know, kind of tampering with witnesses or getting people to say stuff. On his way out, he spoke to two employees, but then the prosecution believes that they paid these people to say this.
If the witnesses are to be believed, it paints a picture.
Yeah. He came back to work after lunch and went back to his office to finish his books. And this was verified because an employee came in and asked Frank for a small advance on his pay. He left to go home that evening at around 6 when Newt Lee came back the second time to start his shift. Frank said, "The statement of that Negro Conley is a tissue of lies from first to last. I know nothing whatsoever of the cause of death of Mary Fagan, and Conley's statements as to his coming up and helping me dispose of the body, or that I had anything to do with him that day, is a monstrous lie." He also emphatically denied that he ever said anything inappropriate to any of the girls at the factory. He said that it was a base lie.
But 19 of them.
19. He told about his nervousness and peculiar behavior in the beginning and explained that, hey, being woke up in the morning to look at the mutilated body of a young girl is unsettling. He said, "Gentlemen, I was nervous. I was completely unstrung. It was a scene that would have melted stone." And that made so much sense to me.
Yeah. Except he was so cold during the trial, too.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, he's cold-natured.
Right. But you know, some people just are.
And you really can't judge somebody based on how they react to
We know that now, although
I still do it.
But I think his testimony was compelling.
Yeah, I think so. I do agree it was compelling based on that.
In closing arguments, Frank's defense claimed they wouldn't even be there if Frank were not a Jew. Remember the strange statements that I said they'd made regarding the girls' claims? Deliver me from these prudish fellows that never look at a girl and never puts his hand on her and is always talking about his own virtue.
Who said this?
This is his attorney.
You see, I think the guy was a pervert. I'm just thinking, okay, 19 people. If you tell me 3 people, I would be like, well, you know, but 19 people have come forward. And now that statement, yeah.
He told jurors, we are not trying this man for everything that might have been said about him. We are trying him for murder.
Okay.
Arnold, the defense attorney, said that Jim Conley was the murderer and that he, quote, laid in his cell and conjured up a monstrous story. The story was preposterous, he said, and contradicted on numerous points by the evidence. Arnold went on and said that the murder was committed by a drunken, crazed Negro, hard up for money. He put forth the theory that Conley was robbing Mary. She was missing the money. But I feel like either way, like even if Frank had put him up to it, he probably would have stole her money.
Right.
I just think he wasn't a great guy.
Obviously. He's got some credibility issues here.
Mm-hmm.
He admitted to being a part of it, though.
He did. And Conley had Mary's blood on his shirt. And he had a lot of intimate knowledge about the murderer. But then again, here's something. Frank was paying Conley a lot more than a janitor's wage. And even more than other employees with a lot more experience doing more significant work. And for what? He was a Black man. You know, that's sad, but they were not paid as well.
No, they would not have been. And so it sounds like he was paying him to keep his mouth shut about all those girls.
I mean, that doesn't look good. Now, Luther Rosser, Leo's other defense lawyer, made shocking racist comments while he was, you know, giving his closing arguments. He said, Conley is a plain, beastly, drunken, filthy, lying N-word.
Wow.
With a spreading nose through which probably tons of cocaine have probably been sniffed.
Good grief.
So it's weird to me that they would try to claim racism.
This was his statement in court.
This was his statement in court. This was his closing argument.
Wow.
The prosecution painted Conley to make him look like a respectable Negro. This is him too. This is what he's saying. But the juror should not be fooled by a trained parrot.
Wow.
He said if they believed him and convicted Leo Frank, that it would be a shame on this great city.
So he's accusing them of racism while making these racist comments.
Yes.
That's kind of so bizarre.
It's so bizarre. And then Hugh Dorsey, this is the prosecutor, and he accused the defense of appealing to racial prejudice, which I agree, against Black people.
Mm-hmm.
He denied the accusations made by the defense that Frank was, you know, persecuted or prosecuted because he was a Jew. He talked about many great Jewish people throughout history and said Frank was a disgrace to all of them. He said that Jews are a great people. This is a quote, quote, people who rise to heights sublime, but they sink to the depths of degradation too. And they are amenable to the same laws as you and I and the Black race. Unquote. I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
He looked at Frank and said, you assaulted her and she resisted. She wouldn't yield. You struck her and you ravaged her and she was unconscious. And then he said, you killed Mary Fagan to save your reputation because dead people tell no tales.
Mm-hmm.
Dorsey closed with, there can be but one verdict, and that is guilty. On August 25th, the jury deliberated 4 hours, and they returned with a guilty verdict, and Frank was sentenced to death. So after this, you know, of course, they started trying to appeal.
Right. That always happens.
Yeah, to the grand jury, right? Adolph, A-D-O-L-P-H, O-C-H-S, Ox, right? Adolph Ox?
Or Oaks?
Yeah.
So I don't know.
But anyway, he was the publisher of the New York Times. And he sent some of their reporters to Georgia because they and many other Northerners believed and stood behind Frank and felt like he had been wrongly convicted because he was Jewish and because he was a Northerner. And the South did not take kindly to this meddling. Mm. And so even though I don't think it was a racial thing on the prosecution's part during the trial, but I think it became
that
after. All out media war kind of got started. So this brought out this racist, anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic man named Tom Watson, who used his newspaper, the Jeffersonian, to incite, you know, these Southerners against Northerners for paying for his for Frank's defense. So 2 years after the murder, when the Supreme Court denied Frank's request for a new trial, over a million people signed petitions and thousands sent letters asking Georgia's governor, John Slayton, to commute Frank's death sentence to life imprisonment. John Roan, I don't know if you remember him, but he was the judge during the trial. Well, he actually wrote Governor Slayton a letter. And he asked him to review the case, and he admitted that he had questioned Leo Frank's guilt. You know, Slayton was threatened, you know, that he had better uphold this death penalty, but he just felt like he didn't really have a choice but to look into it.
Yeah. And goodness, I mean, it does seem like it's just one person's word against another. And one of them obviously is not a credible person at all.
Right.
The other one I'm not so sure about. And it's just hard. It's hard to know.
Before I go into this part right here, I just want to say, I don't think that he could have been convicted today. Leo Frank.
Because
I don't think
there was not evidence. Enough evidence. Right. That's what I'm thinking.
So anyway, Slayton felt like he needed to, like it was his duty. He wrote a lot about this, and I believe he took this seriously. I really do. He was hated after this, but I think that he was wise. But he wrote that the charge against the state of Georgia of racial prejudice was unfair. He said a conspicuous Jewish family in Georgia is descended from one of the original colonial families of the state. He said Jews have been presidents of our boards of education, principals in our schools, mayors in our cities, and conspicuous in all of our commercial enterprises. So he just felt like that was unfounded. This is also him as well. I'm quoting this, by the way. Many newspapers and non-residents have declared that Frank was convicted without any evidence to sustain the verdict. But in large measure, those giving expression to this utterance have not read the evidence, and they are not acquainted with the facts. The same may be said regarding many of those who are demanding his execution. He said, in my judgment, no one has the right to an opinion who is not acquainted with the evidence in the case. And it must be conceded, those who saw the witnesses and beheld their demeanor upon the stand are in the best position, as a general rule, to reach the truth. And he said, I cannot, within a short time, decide the case. That would be really hard, but he did have a few things that he could look over, and that's what he decided to do. In reference to Conley, he said that it was hard to believe that any man could make up such a story, you know, minute by minute details, and stick to it the way Conley did, unless there was some truth to it. But it all came back to the poop in the elevator shaft.
I've been wondering about that poop.
Conley testified that on the morning of April 26th, he went down into the basement to relieve his bowels and pooped in the elevator shaft. He admitted that, right? Mm-hmm. On the morning of April 27th, when detectives came down the basement, you know, when the electricity was turned off, they came down by the ladder. When they were looking all around the basement for evidence, they also looked in the shaft.
Mm-hmm.
They saw the human excrement.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in its natural condition. In other words, it was intact. It wasn't smushed. So gross.
It is gross.
Conley admitted that, you know, he had run that elevator for a year and a half before.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been many times up and down on it. And it only stops when it hits the ground in the basement. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, it goes all the way to the bottom. Well, later when investigators used that elevator to go down to the basement, when Frank had turned on the electricity, it smushed the poop.
I'm not following.
Okay, so when they first came, the investigators, when they first got there, they saw the body, you know, they were looking over everything. They looked all around the basement for evidence, right? They also looked as well in the elevator shaft, right?
Yeah.
So they saw that poop there.
Yeah, and it was intact. That morning,
and it was intact.
Okay.
Conley said that he used the bathroom that morning.
Okay.
The murder happened...
Sometime during the night.
No, it happened around... sometime after 12.
Because the body was found at 3.
The body was found at 3 in the morning. This happened in the afternoon. Remember, she went to get her pay from Frank, and it happened sometime right after that.
Okay.
I mean, within the hour.
Okay.
Anyway, he said that he could not... Remember, Frank wanted him to take her body down by himself, but he said that he could not... lift it, or he couldn't do it by himself.
Right.
So Frank helped him, and that they together rode the elevator down there.
Mm-hmm.
Had that been true, that poop would have been smushed.
Oh, the elevator had not been taken. So that kind of discounted his story there.
Yes. When they went down that second time, it was smushed, and that's when it released that
smell,
you know,
that
horrible smell.
Well, I'm sorry. I got to ask this. Did they not have indoor bathrooms? Like, why did he do that in the elevator shaft to begin with?
I think he was a drunk. They said that he would, like pee all over
disgusting.
The pencils. And
oh, and that's another thing. Her body had urine on it.
It did.
And he's kind of disgusting.
Yes. And he was known to pee all over the pencils. And that was another thing. Like, why would Frank pay him so much? He wasn't a great employee.
And on the flip side of that, because I was thinking, well, what kind of person's going to be your lookout and turn a blind eye while you're doing this? Like, that's you're a horrible person for doing that. But that would hold up to be, like, he would be the kind of person.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that's proof that Conley lied about him and Frank bringing Mary's body down the elevator together.
It is.
Later that day. And so Governor Slant, he actually went to the pencil factory himself, and he rode that elevator twice.
Oh, good on him.
And he just wanted to know. Like, Slanton said with Frank's size that
you say he was like 5'6".
Yeah. And they said that there was no way that he could have carried Mary's body down that hatchway by himself. But Conley
could have.
Probably could have. He was big. It wouldn't have been easy.
Yeah.
But he could have. He could have got her down there. And I don't know if you remember, but she had that cord
around her neck.
And they believe that that was
used. She'd been
dropped
through that hole. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Conley was also the one who admitted to writing the notes found by the body.
And he had lied prior to that he was illiterate.
And he had lied. 3 days before leaving office, Slayton commuted Frank's sentence to life imprisonment. And you can imagine how well that went over. Not very well. And I do believe that he wanted to do the right thing. It seems like he used wisdom. He wasn't saying that Frank was innocent, but that did give him a chance that he could prove his innocence. He didn't even get a second trial. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And without the evidence, there is
reasonable doubt
about it.
Yes.
Regardless of what kind of person he was, there's reasonable doubt that he was the actual one that did it. So you hate to see somebody be put to death when there's a shred of doubt.
Exactly.
Based on the testimony of you know, a liar.
Right. Knowing that a lynch mob would likely form, Governor Slayton ordered that Frank be moved in the middle of the night to an unknown facility. I mean, it was serious.
And it's, yeah.
The people were not happy. And a mob actually went to the governor's house, and he was being called like the traitor of Georgia.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, crazy stuff. But, you know, his wife said that she would rather be the widow of a courageous man than the wife of a coward.
Well, that says a lot about her.
And she stood, you know, behind her husband's decision. The National Guard had to be called in to protect him. And even then,
he had some close calls. I was going
to
say, I didn't even know they did that back then.
Yeah, it was bad. He ended up having to go to New York, and his career was
over
here for sure. But Tom Watson, remember that guy I told you that was kind of inciting that violence here? He continued working Southerners into that frenzy and convincing them that, you know, these New York rich Jews would see to it that Frank was going to be acquitted and Mary Fagan was never going to see justice unless they had the courage to take it into their own hands.
And it doesn't take very many voices to do that, to rile people up.
Oh, no, no. So prisoners, they had heard that a mob had threatened to come in and start shooting to get revenge. And they were afraid that they were going to be killed in the crossfire. And a prisoner slashed Leo Frank's throat.
Good night.
He was in critical condition for weeks. But then another prisoner, who was a surgeon and a convicted murderer, actually saved his life. He stitched him back up or he would have died.
Wow.
But then on August 16th, 1915, a mob of armed men in seven cars, who named themselves the Knights of Mary Fagan, drove up to the prison at 10 o'clock at night. These were doctors.
Oh, these were preachers. Oh, my goodness.
These were prominent citizens of Marietta, Georgia, and they cut the phone lines.
Oh, my.
So that help couldn't be called. They pulled guns on the guard at the gate and demanded to be let in. And then they kidnapped Leo Frank.
Wow.
They put him in the car and drove 175 miles back to Marietta. They forced Frank to stand up on a table. And then one of the leaders said, "Mr. Frank, we're now going to do what the law says to do. We're going to hang you by the neck until you're dead. Do you want to make any statements before you die?"
Whoa.
And at first he said no, but then he declared, you know, his innocence one more time, and he asked that his wedding ring be returned to his wife. Yeah, the table was kicked out from under him. Word spread really quickly that Leo Frank's body was hanging from a tree in the backwoods of Marietta, and hundreds of people came to gawk. People attacked his body. Man. They took the clothes off of him as souvenirs. You know how people do with that? We've talked about that.
We have.
Photographers snapped pictures of his dead body, and the photographs were made into postcards.
What?
They were sold like all around the South. Yeah. And one of them, Frank's, I've seen these pictures, sad to say, but in one of them, Frank's head is twisted at a 90-degree angle. His hands are tied in front of him. His feet are swinging in the air. And you can see a crowd of men and children around him looking just so proud of themselves.
Man, that's grotesque. I mean,
some even, you know, they were posing with his dead body. No one in the mob was ever charged for the lynching. And a few months later, members of the Knights of Mary Fagan reassembled to the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh.
And would go on to terrorize people for years to come.
That doesn't surprise me. I was sitting here thinking, that sounds like something from the KKK or something.
Yeah.
So they actually did.
Yeah. Yeah. And hundreds of Jewish families, they ended up leaving Atlanta because, I mean,
well, they were probably scared. Yeah.
And then in 1982, in a twist. Another twist. Alonzo Mann, who he was a past employee. He was like an office boy for Leo Frank. And he came forward when he was in his 80s. He said that he had been there that day and that he had seen Jim Conley carry Mary's body but he was too afraid to say anything because Conley threatened to kill him if he told anyone. And when he told his parents about it, they told him to stay out of it. He produced a sworn affidavit, and his statement, they were actually used to obtain a posthumous pardon with an exoneration for Leo Frank.
Well, that's a little late.
From the Georgia State Boards of Pardons and Paroles. And the effort was led by the Jewish Anti-Defamation League. The further away, though, we've talked about this before, in time a memory is from the original event, the easier it is to exploit and manipulate. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand why he didn't come forward earlier.
Well, when you were reading it, I was thinking, 80 years old, why you had plenty of years to change your mind and come forward. Like, I don't know if I'm buying that.
Yeah, me either. The ADL, I don't know if you're familiar with the Anti-Defamation League. It's a Jewish organization that says they fight hate for good. They were actually born out of this. They were formed, and now they do a lot of work for the LGBTQ community and lots of other. So for the record, though, Mary Fagan's family is still 100% convinced that Leo Frank was the murderer. They say information has been suppressed, and they believe it's insane that Frank could be pardoned based on the testimony of a man who could have come forward years ago.
And okay, whew, that's a whole lot to unwrap right there. Okay, I didn't know if you had more. I didn't want to start delving into my thoughts until...
Actually, Leo Frank was the only Jewish person who was ever hanged in the United States, as far as we know.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Well, that is... Oh, gosh, I don't know. I mean, as you continued to tell the story, my mind would say, but this, oh, but wait a minute, no, that. It was all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm still trying to gather my thoughts. But I do think that Leo Frank was propositioning those girls.
Right.
There were so many. I do think he was guilty of that. I do think he had a perversion.
Mm-hmm.
And that can lead to the death of a young lady, especially right. one who's going to fight for her rights.
Right.
I also believe Conley could be just as guilty. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a drunk. He was obviously a horrible, disgusting person.
He had something to do with it.
He had something, and he admits that.
Yeah.
I don't understand why he would place himself at the crime and say that he had done this. Like, if he had done it, I think he probably, if he had no sense, wouldn't even have placed himself at the crime. He would have just kept lying.
Yeah.
I don't think he would have placed himself at the crime and then just said, I helped. I don't know. Yeah. That seems a little weird. But then again, I mean, you know, he's a drunk. Who knows?
Mary Fagan's grandfather actually went to see him because, you know, he served some time mm-hmm. for accessory. And he actually went to the jail and saw him. He wanted to talk to him, like mm-hmm. what in the world, and he came away believing him.
He did.
And also, I didn't say this because I've read this in Mary Fagan's family's, they have a blog mm-hmm. about her case, and I've seen it in a couple of other places that are, I guess you call, say, anti Leo Frank supporters. Mm-hmm. But supposedly there is a girl, and I didn't write her name down, but there is a girl who came to testify at the trial who was actually at the time in an unwed mother's home who was pregnant by Leo Frank, who had been brutally bitten in her vulva.
Wow.
By him. I mean, like, bad. Like, had a... was mutilated, basically.
Yeah.
By him. And that was her testimony. Again, I want to say I could not substantiate that.
That was just a claim.
That was a claim. And I have read it in several places.
So, again, I had said earlier, you know, if you don't want to be put on death row for a crime you didn't commit, don't do stuff that makes you look guilty to begin with.
Right.
And that stands true for Leo Frank. If he didn't do it, well, you know, your past behavior has caught up with you anyway.
Right.
Unfortunately.
Right.
And the same thing with Conley. He obviously, he was a liar. So even some of the stuff, like the whole elevator and the poop thing, they're not, people are still have questions based on mm-hmm. the fact that he's not truthful at all times.
Right.
So even though he may be being truthful at this time, it's hard to know.
It is.
And then that evidence that goes, oh goodness, both ways. So we know Conley had something to do with it.
Right.
We just don't know if he's setting up somebody else in addition to himself or if he's telling the truth. But either way, I think both of these men were horrible.
Yeah. Well, okay. Let me say this now mm-hmm. on the other side.
Yeah.
Because you know.
You got to play both sides.
Right. I also could not substantiate, mm-hmm. but read in a few different sources that Mary's friend that she was with that day, George, mm-hmm. I can't remember.
Epps,
that he said that he had been pressured to say that she was afraid of Leo Frank.
Oh, he had been pressured.
And a few of those girls, a few of those 19 girls came forward and said the same thing.
Ah, you just keep throwing stuff at me that makes me second guess what my assumption is.
I mean, it is. He could have, he definitely could have had something to do with it and probably did. But there is a chance. I don't think he should have been convicted because there is definitely reasonable doubt he could have had nothing to do with it.
Yeah. If I was a juror on that case, even if I was convinced, if there was that much doubt about the thing, I wouldn't be able to convict. I would want to.
Right.
But I wouldn't be able to based on there is that reasonable doubt that what if what I've heard is not even true about him?
Yeah. So, I mean, well, a madam came forward in Atlanta saying that he had called her that day and said that he was coming in with a young girl. And it came to, it was a lie.
She lied about
it? She lied. And that was so it is hard. People are not always honest. They don't always tell the truth.
They're not. Yeah.
So yeah, that's my crazy case.
That was crazy. I don't even know what to think. Well, I don't want to be sympathetic to murderers or pedophiles.
You don't want to put it off on somebody. That's a lot. You don't want to put it off on somebody that it doesn't, you know, that's innocent. But at the same time, I don't give a rip what race they are.
Yeah, if they're horrible
if they're
people.
White, if they're black, if they're Jewish, if they're Chinese, whatever.
If they're guilty.
We're all capable.
Yes.
We're human beings are capable of great and terrible things.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
Yeah,
so those were some hard times.
Those were some really hard times.
According to labor laws written in 1900, back then, the best way to protect your cotton picking kids is to tell everybody you know and a few people you don't to check out Hard Times and True Crimes. Till next time, goodbye.